Hello, Peach Pearls listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Getting to Know Your Research. Today, I am excited to be joined by Dr. Joyce Tang, professor of dermatology at Stanford University and longtime PEDRA member and mentor. And joining Dr. Tang is her mentee, fourth-year medical student Austin Johnson, who recently just matched to dermatology residency at Stanford and will be continuing his work with Dr. Tang. Well, thank you both so much for being with me today. I so appreciate your time. And I'm very excited to be talking about the PEDRA Research Fellowship grant that you received back in 2022 about epidermolysis bullosa simplex disease activity and response tool, a scoring clinical severity and outcomes in epidermolysis bullosa simplex. So that's a big title. I know some of our listeners probably are wondering, what does that even mean? So Dr. Tang, could you just break that down for me real quick?
Yeah, I'll be delighted to. And so let me perhaps start by providing a little background regarding epidermolysis bullosa. Many of you are probably already familiar with epidermolysis bullosa. It's a rare genetic, monogenetic skin disease that result in skin fragility, blistering, and many other clinical manifestations. So there are many different type of EB depending on where the genetic mutation occurs, so what type of a genetic mutation there is. So there, a simple way to classify this is that some of the EB subtypes are relatively superficial and others are deep. The dystrophic EB, of course, you know, many of you have heard from the recent development in this field that can lead to significant impact on quality of life and of those that are impacted. EB simplex, although it's less severe, but affect way more people than dystrophic EB. So it's the most common subtype of EB. Despite that, and currently there's no FDA-approved therapy for EB simplex. And EB simplex sometimes are relatively localized, but other times it can generalize. It still has a significant impact on people's quality of life, and especially for babies and infants. And some of the generalized severe EB simplex, you can actually, it's really difficult to distinguish the first few weeks or few months of life from the most severe type of the dystrophic EB. There's a significant unmet medical need in therapeutic development, but before we can develop any adequate clinical treatment and evaluate the efficacy of this treatment and how patients are cared for, we have to understand the severity of the disease itself. That is really the goal of this project that we proposed, so that we have a standard measurement to assessing the severity of the disease itself.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tang, for that overview. Now I'd like to go to Austin. Austin, tell me a little bit more about how you became involved with this project.
First of all, thanks for having me on as well. I think I was both very lucky and grateful for this opportunity, as well as the opportunity to be at Stanford Medical School. I think this wouldn't have been an opportunity without being at the right place at the right time. And that's to the point of, like Dr. Tang mentioning, this is a rare genetic blistering disease. And there was sort of this serendipitous time where I was taking a research year, really interested in everything that was happening EB at Stanford, and really, like, especially it, with the RDEB trials and everything that was coming through there, there was also a kindling for EBS. There was a phase 1/2a clinical trial starting at the around the same time. And I wanted to understand not only hopefully bringing the field forward in terms of like this new potential therapy, again, with no FDA approved treatment, but also like helping the field in terms of having the instruments necessary should these new therapies continue to come about, and promoting that. And I think there was this alignment of interest between Dr. Tang, who had just been running some EBS trials as well, at the same time, identifying this need, not only in the EBS community, but in store of the EBS instrument. There was no like dedicated EBS instrument. And we have really well-validated and reliable tools for EB in general. But as Dr. Tain alluded to, EBS in particular is a spectrum within a spectrum, it ranging from very mild to very severe, that changes with seasonality and it changes with differences in age and what people engage in. And for me, it was really interesting. And I came to Dr. Tang with an interest in also learning the methodology behind these trials, not necessarily just conducting them, even though that was really important, but also hopefully contributing such that new trials have like more of an impetus and an ability to have clinically responsive tools that reliably assess the severity of its participants, as well as the potential efficacy of these tools. So it was a really serendipitous time is the best way to put it shortly.
So let's talk about the tool itself. How did you go about putting this project together, putting this tool together?
A lot of the research went into this. And as Austin just alluded to, one word to characterize this condition is heterogeneity. And the severity varies so much, and the fluctuation in a way that sometimes that these diseases can somewhat mirror those blistering disease, other type of a blistering disease, inflammatory skin diseases. So we actually dived really deep into the literature to study those instruments that were previously developed for other rare genetic skin diseases, such as ichthyosis. And we looked at the instruments for inflammatory skin diseases, such as atopic dermatitis and psoriasis. And we combined many of the concepts and then, relate that into the characteristic, clinical characteristic of EB simplex itself, then came up with this tool that hopefully captures the extent of the skin involvement, as well as some of the clinical characteristic of this disease itself.
I think Dr. Tang hit it all, that we were really trying to synthesize all the progress that has been made in all these disease severity indices for different skin diseases, and also build upon, like I mentioned previously, these validated tools in EB that were good at distinguishing types and overall severities. But for EBS in particular, given that it's more mild, not necessarily like the assessing the dynamicity of that. So like EB-DASI and iScore EB, those were all the foundation of the content from here. And then we synthesized what worked in other disease states such as atopic dermatitis, ichthyosis, and use that to create a tool that also had, in addition to a rating system, photographic and written standards that allowed these evaluators, investigators to have a shared understanding of the different severity. Again, because it's oftentimes very difficult, even week to week, to assess the severity of EBS patients, depending on what they're doing at the time, what season it is, and at what stage in the trial they could be. So I think it was really about getting an amalgamation of everything and optimizing that for EBS in particular, using the literature that we already had.
So throughout this project, what were some of the things, Austin, that you learned that surprised you?
I would say it's hard to pin down one thing. I learned so, so much throughout this process, both from Dr. Tang and from collaborating with Pedra and all the EB experts across the country, to be honest. It was really, really nice to be in this space where there was such collaboration on the content validation and how to design instruments and really learn every stage of the way. And I think it was in parallel with being involved in the TAMES trial that was going on here for EBS that I learned how important this was, because in the TAMES trial, we were using an investigator's global assessment, which is more of a general tool to assess severity, on a scale of 1 to 4. And this showed me that like something like EBS start was needed in that. But I also learned how many levels of complexity there are to assessing reliability, validity, and also the collaboration necessary across multiple sites when you do have a rare disease. You need to involve many, many parties at different levels. And it was also really interesting to learn how, as we kind of shift into this digital age of hopefully having maybe less centralized clinical trials, especially for rare genetic blistering diseases such as EB, where travel across the country could result in a worsening disease state, that it's super important to develop these tools in the context of the technology we have. And I think that was also built in with inherent challenges. Like, for example, how do we standardize these photographs when, for example, there's a relative paucity of those? And how do we optimize what we have with maybe the limited information? And also, how do we involve everyone with in a level playing field, so to speak, where, for example, some people use different computers with different resolutions and different lighting and all that, and how that can actually affect the way you validate the instrument. It's not just, you know, the quality that you put into the content. It's also the quality of the actual tests and retests that you do. And I think that was really interesting for me in terms of methodologic learning as well. So it's every step of the way has been a great learning experience, including that of the current data analysis that we're undergoing now that we have some retest values from all these experts who are very, very busy and have contributed so much to the project.
Well, and I do want to get to those data that you just referred to, but I want to go to Dr. Ting first because I want to kind of tease out this mentorship piece of this program and this project. And those challenges you were just talking about, Austin, those to somebody like me, all of those variables seem insurmountable. So Dr. Ting, you have been a part of the research field and you're an expert in EB. How do you go about mentoring students like Austin on projects like this and helping guide them through the various stages of a study and also thinking through all those different variables? How do you mentor on a project like this?
I'm so glad that you asked that question. Austin had the advantage of being on site, and as he mentioned, it was a wonderful, in terms of the timing, it was a wonderful opportunity because he gets to do these, try to develop this more abstract, concept of tools and get to do all the technical component to set up, get an IRB. And get photographs, collect them, modifying them on the computer, set up a red cap, and do all these technical working on these technical elements. On the other hand, we have monthly EB clinic, and he has a firsthand experience what the patient's experience are, and when we talk about the keratoderma, when we're talking about blisters. And he gets to screen charts and patients and participating a pilot clinical trial, which is a rare opportunity. So all these stars are just a lineup. And for me, as a more of a advisor, it's a habit. And you say, oh, this is what you need to do. But really for a young trainee and young investigator, it's really helpful for them to develop a method and a way to organizing their research project themselves. So we do meet every week or every other week and talk about, where we are, where things are, and, what are the action items? Where are the barrier? And, what are the challenges that we're facing? And so I kind of a hint and point the way, and this is what you need to look into, this is what you need to do. And then Austin goes out and he's very, very resourceful and figure out a way to get around, and then we come back and we optimize what we have achieved and we take the next step. And so I think a communication is really the key. And being transparent to see where things are, and just sometimes being a mentor is to just be there for them and to be able to support them. And so help to guide them slightly. But, you know, that experience of trying to find the resources and know how to get an answer, sometimes it's more important than the knowing the answer itself.
Oh, boy, isn't that true? Let's talk about the data. So I know you're not published, and I know you just got to a place where you're beginning to analyze the data. So what can you speak to about what you know so far?
Thanks for asking that. This is really exciting. I was literally just before this starting to look at the retest data. So breaking this down, we're really looking for the reliability and validity between raters and also raters across time. So that first bit of data, like between all these raters, we had EB experts across country collaborate on this. And we had 9 people in particular who had extensive experience. They applied their knowledge to a set of test photographs after seeing our written and photographic standards and did this all digitally. So nothing was on paper. Previously, I would say most of what you see in the literature is either, you know, in person where you actually have the patient in the room and you're looking at the skin and you're grading that way, or some photos are sent out via snail mail or the like. So this is kind of a novel means to initially validate a tool like the EBS Dart. So we sent it out via computer, Qualtrics surveys, captured all this data. And so far, from what we can see on the reliability and the ICCs associated with that, those measures, that there are certain elements of EBS that have more agreement across these raters. So things, for example, that are more specific to EBS, like keratoderma on the palms and soles, have better agreement than something, for example, like erosions, which, you know, in the setting of having this 2D image, not being able to palpate or pan around in a 3D scan, may be a little bit more difficult to evaluate, especially when we have this spectrum of disease in EBS. And also, in addition to that, certain anatomical regions, for example, like the palms and the trunk, were easier and more agreed upon than other areas like the upper extremities or the soles, for that matter. So it's really interesting to see this data right now that it's not uniform. And actually, that kind of reflects what EBS is as this kind of heterogeneous dynamic disease. And it also allows us to begin thinking on how to iterate a tool like this. And it, for example, like making sure everything is uniform in the future, having dedicated photo repositories of standardized photos, these images, because these initial photos and the test photos and the standards all came from trials where people weren't necessarily thinking about using them for an instrument, but were nonetheless integral to having this stage. And so there's a lot of different things that are coming out of that besides the hard data. It's also more so like, how do we optimize this further? And then what we're doing right now is determining that intra-rater reliability, the test-retest, to see how consistent we can get raters to be across, you know, a month or more of seeing the same photos. So that's kind of the progress being made in the highlights so far.
And I think that as Austin mentioned, the data itself has taught us that, for instance, that what anatomical locations are important to when it comes to clinical trials and what we really need to focus on and how we should weigh and what are the important area to assess, right? And wherever the disease are more consistent in presence of less fluctuation, and those are the area that we really need to focus on during the study. And also, it'll be very important for future designing the duration or the length of the a clinical trial itself. And some of the clinical characteristics, you may or may not see improvement within 4 weeks, 8 weeks. And in term of trial designs, it might need, you know, longer, 16 weeks to 20 weeks. And so those are all, you know, specific important details that can be learned from this exercise that you know we're doing. And then also the other important aspects is really pointing to future studies. We have analyzed hundreds of pictures, but it's still not enough. And we need more investigators to contribute and to standardize how we acquire and collect these information in the future in clinic as well. And just like the inflammatory skin disorders, right now, many centers are interested in, when I see a psoriasis patient, for instance, here's the template I'm going to use. And these are the questions that I'm going to ask for the psoriasis patient. We should start doing that with rare disease or EB simplex as well, that these are some of the standards and questions we need to learn. And if we're taking photographs, and these are the photographs that we need to obtain, and that these are the anatomical locations that we should assess. And so those are very important. And also, what we learn is that even with the limited number of photographs that we have, and limited to a couple of hundreds, and children and adults are very different. There's a big age difference. And when we may in the future need to assess younger patients differently as to how we assess adults and older population. So many important things, subgroups that are important to be looked at in the future.
Okay, so we've sort of been talking high level throughout this entire interview about what this tool means and how important it is for the field. But just if you could put it in simple terms, you're in clinic, you're talking to a patient. What does having a tool like this mean for them?
I think with patients like these, like you want to give them a standardization, like an objective measure to say, like, here is where you are on the scale. We're going to try to get you from here to here. In addition, if they're in a trial, then they understand the endpoints between this. And I think prior to this, it's often subjective, like mild today, you're moderate tomorrow, but what are those features based off of? I think what we've learned also is that rare disease populations like the EB community are so plugged in and understanding of what's going on too, that giving them an objective means to hold on to how they are doing and how, the dynamics of their disease is really important. So I think a tool like the EBS Dart has both like clinical and translational implications, in the sense of you can go to the EB clinic and have that severity where, for example, 6 months ago, maybe you were at a 30 and now you're at a 10 or wherever that scale would be. And that also helps validate and assess efficacy of these new treatments coming down the pipeline. So in that setting, you're also seeing how effective truly is this, versus going from like a 4 to a 1, you can actually see a 10-point drop or have a really responsive tool. So I think in simpler terms for the patients, it gives what Dr. Tang was mentioning, like this objectiveness to an otherwise very dynamic disease. And that's very difficult to do. I think that's many of the learning points we had throughout this study, but it nonetheless is possible.
Austin probably told you that he matched the Stanford. We're very excited. And he's going to spend a year in Colorado and then come back for a derm residency. And, I told him that he's going to be the most experienced resident at EB, and hopefully we'll get our manuscript done as well in the next couple of months. And so we're all very exciting.
Yeah. I feel very honored to be able to continue the work here. I think I love continuity, being from my small hometown of Colorado and then coming to the world of opportunity here. I began to realize just like how important even little so-called little things like instrument validation can be for a population that, for example, doesn't have an FDA approved treatment for their disease. And I think that's like one of the biggest honors in medical school and hopefully in residency now too, is to continue that effort and be on the team for everyone there. And it's really exciting. And in addition to that, also seeing how this tool began, we also had like a regional meeting for Deborah in employed this tool in the in-person like setting, like it's usually done in with the literature. And so we have that data as well that we're going trying to combine and see if it performs better one way or another. That'll be really helpful in telling like these future directions and how to use it in interventional studies. But yeah, very excited to continue that in the next 4 years and beyond, hopefully. So yeah, it was a great opportunity to begin this so early on in my medical career.
This is a very different project, and people don't realize, you know, how much work that go into these kind of study. So it's exciting to finally see it coming to at least, you know, the first stage, first phase of the study we're concluding.
Yeah, it's really exciting to hear all of this. And Austin, I'm so glad that you brought up Deborah and that you were working with Deborah. The patient voice is so valuable. And the number one reason both of you are working on this project is ultimately for the patients. So I'm really happy to hear you involved, Deborah. There's such a wonderful advocacy organization, really doing a lot to support families and people with EB. Well, thank you both so much for joining me today on Getting to Know Your Research. This is a fantastic project. I cannot wait until you're published. So exciting. And congratulations, Austin, on matching into Derm at Stanford. That's very exciting that you get to continue on with Dr. Tang and all this great work that the two of you have already achieved. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for having us.
Yes.
If you have a project that you would like highlighted on Pedra's Getting to Know Your Research show, please send us an email at info@pedraresearch.org. And please don't forget to follow us on our social media channels at Pedra Research. And make sure that you have subscribed to the Pedra Pearls podcast channel so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening.